it does not lead to backbiting, or it does not lead to insulting a third party. Now, one of the areas where one can, talk about his problems, those problems could be secret problems, but he can talk to to consult someone like a doctor. The doctor asks you certain questions about your illnesses, about your problems, and then if you don't, if you do not disclose your secrets to him, he might not be able to reach a diagnosis, and therefore it is permissible as long as it does not lead to some kind of backbiting or insulting other people.
Oh, I see. Some of these doctors, basically psychologists, pry into their patients' affairs. With the reason that they want to, diagnose their mental problems.
Yeah.
So is it permissible for the doctors to do so, basically? Like, to get very deep with the private affairs and secrets of their patients?
Now, psychologists you mentioned, of course.
Yes.
Well, the psychologists need to know certain things in order to find the cause of the mental problem the client may be suffering from.
Yes.
And therefore, they need to know the ins and outs of everything in order to come to a decision and to give the proper advice.
Yes.
So as long as the motivation is to find the cause and to reach a conclusion, of course, they can keep asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
Provided that it does not to lead to any vile consequences,
right.
Any corruption or backbiting or something negative.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. So the limit is lies within their religious capacity, which entails that kind of diagnostic, for example, investigation.
Yes.
that psychologist deals with. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away. To the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, some people talk about certain negative aspects or even weaknesses within the Islamic government or governments. What is the view, on listening to such conversations?
Well, according to the opinion of His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if such conversations actually tarnish the image of the Islamic Republic and the system which is in place,
mm-hmm.
and of course it is not permissible, because if such conversations lead to weakening of the Islamic Republic, so it obviously is not permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, generally speaking, it's not permissible for a Muslim to engage in a conversation to create, create a negative impression in the mind of the listener about the Islamic Republic system. and such an Islamic Republic or the Islamic government, which stands against infidelity, which fights against world arrogance, and of course we need to keep up fighting the infidelity and world arrogance. And if this conversation leads to weakening of the image of the Islamic Republic, and also changing the mind of the listener about the positive image that he has about the Islamic Republic, it's not permissible.
I see. Is it permissible to wear clothes which bear foreign pictures and inscriptions? And what is, is it considered a means of spreading Western culture?
Well, there is no objection to it in itself, unless it leads to some social decay. And of course, also if it leads to some, if the picture he is wearing, or the picture that on the cloth he is wearing, is such, it looks so offensive that it's kind of degrading for that individual who is wearing that, then it's not permissible. Otherwise, if it does not lead to social decay and if it's not degrading for that individual who is wearing that picture, there is no problem. As for judging it as a way of spreading Western culture, of course, it should be left to the common sense.
Sometimes we talk about Western culture, and sometimes we talk about religious symbols, such as crosses, for example, or emblems, or whatever that that are reminiscent of some other religious sects and denominations. What's the ruling on that regard?
Well, again, it has to be, I think we need to differentiate. There are situations in which wearing a garment, an outfit, let's say, with a cross is permissible.
Necklaces, for example.
Let me give you an example. For example, those people working for the Red Cross.
Yes.
And that Red Cross is working, is functioning in an Islamic country. Yes. So they have a special garment. And that cross does not mean that actually it is forbidden. It's a kind of indecency that is promoted. It's not permissible. So, but when it comes to some kind of symbols, like satanic symbols, and those symbols which represent certain ideologies, and the aim is to prevent, to spread certain ideology, and to misguide the young generation, especially. So it is obviously not permissible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, Ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shir Chavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Shachar, what's the jurisprudential law on selling, buying, and wearing foreign clothes?
Well, this is a very good question to ask and to answer also at the same time. Of course, there is no objection to importing and selling or even buying and using such clothes merely due to their being imported from non-Islamic countries. Of course, Muslims can import such goods from non-Muslim countries, because as long as they need those garments, those clothes, and those crews are not, you know, do not, for example, have special symbols with them to reflect in a bad image. And of course, it's not permissible to import, sell, buy, or even wear clothes which would constitute a kind of affront to Islamic decency and morals, or things which would be seen as the promotion of Western culture. And of course, we do know that certain fashions or clothings which are imported, they are quite offensive, mm-hmm. because they reflect the image of the Western culture.
Right.
And the promotion of the Western culture is not permissible.
Yes.
So it has to be differentiated.
I see. So what's the ruling in the matter of emulating Western hairstyles?
Well, the criterion for it is being haram is to simulate the enemies of Islam and promote their culture. Now, if someone tries to do this and actually follow the lifestyle of the non-Muslims, mm-hmm. Which are this is such distinct that it is quite clear that it has nothing to do with Islamic values. And if one's intention is to promote such a culture, of course, it's not permissible. And of course, this varies, as we said in the previous episodes, according to different countries, times, and person, mm-hmm. and it's not specifically connected to the West.
Mm, yes.
There might be something which is offensive, mm-hmm. according to Islam, but
yes.
it might come from a country in Southeast Asia,
yes,
or maybe another country that is very close to us. But it might still be offensive according to Islamic Sharia, so it depends.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Shawi. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Maljaa ilaha illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir La ilaha illahum وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Sobh International Media Festival
Part 2.
To become a journalist, you must have a passion to bring forth the truth. You must carry out vast investigations and do research non-stop almost every day. Today I'll be talking to a journalist who, through his fact-finding mission, has become an expert on Islamic jihadi groups. One of his quotes is this: "During my relentless pursuit of the truth, I've discovered that it has many faces, and each one of us will only believe his own definition of what truth is." This is SOAP, and I'm your host, Hassan Tafakoli. Radwan Murtada was born in Libya in 1984 and moved to Lebanon in 1993. In 2007, he started his professional career as a journalist at Al Akhbar newspaper. Since then, he's worked as a journalist, documentary filmmaker, researcher, writer, executive producer, and assignment producer. In 2014, he founded Blue House Film, a production company based in Beirut, Lebanon.
Radwan Murtaza, welcome to the program. Thank you.
Let's move on to another topic, and that is the fact that you were born in Libya, if I'm correct, in 1984. Have you done any work related to Libya? Any documentaries, Libya. Any films or...
I feel nostalgic about Libya. I once made a study in the media outlets in Libya and examined its financiers and supporters, and I found that the UAE and Turkey significantly influenced them. Unfortunately, Libya won't be the same again. Libya is likely to be divided into at least three parts. Overall, I didn't make a documentary on Libya, and I just made this study. By the way, some of my relatives, including aunts and uncles, still reside there.
And that's it. I wanted to have your opinion on the fact that, what do you think, what befell Gaddafi during the Arab uprising, the Arab Spring, okay? How do you evaluate that situation and the fact that the NATOs were involved and all that?
Muammar al-Gaddafi, with his green book and looks, was a supporter of the African Union and its potentials. But he was an unjust Arab leader. The Western Alliance decided to get rid of him within the framework of a plan drawn up for the entire region. It began with protests as part of the so-called the Soft Revolution. Later, protesters were armed, triggering division and civil war. We definitely opposed those who decided to destroy Libya because their goal wasn't to remove Muammar al-Gaddafi from Libya, but to destroy and divide Libya and steal its wealth, especially as Muammar al-Gaddafi was abiding by their orders. Unfortunately, Libya isn't the same. Libya is torn by civil war amid the rise of al-Qaeda and extremist and Salafi jihadi groups. Consequently, I could oppose an unjust dictator, but at the same time, I'm against the destruction of the country and the killing of hundreds of thousands of people in the name of freedom and independence and under false slogans.
Yeah, so you recently wrote an article about the visit of a senior Hezbollah official to the UAE. How much can this affect the Israeli normalization project?
At the time of the visit of Wafiq Safa, the head of Hezbollah's coordinating committee to the UAE, I wrote an article about this visit, noting that it was pre-planned and was declared at the request of the UAE. Personally, I view the UAE as a den of Israel's Mossad. Alongside Saudi Arabia, the UAE is leading the normalization train. Notably, the Israeli presence in the UAE does not exist in any other country. When a Hezbollah official visited the UAE, I was wondering whether the visit marked the start of a new stage between the movement and the UAE. However, the brief statement issued by Hezbollah at the end of the visit stressed that the visit focused on the issue of Lebanese detainees unjustly held in the Emirati prisons, including Sunnis, Shias, and Christians. Major General Abbas Ibrahim, the former General Director of the Security, was supposed to handle the issue, but the UAE was trying to turn over a new page with the movement in order to protect its interests in Yemen and to ensure the security of its embassy in case it decided to reopen its embassy in Lebanon. Nevertheless, the UAE can be a friend of Israel and Hezbollah at the same time. In 29 Mossad agents entered the UAE, which is known for its iron-fist security measures, and assassinated Mahbub in an ambiguous way to the extent that Hamas initially announced he had died of an incurable disease. However, it was revealed 10 days later that he had been assassinated and the perpetrators of his murder were also identified. The situation in the UAE remains complex. There is also a conflict between Saudi Arabia and the UAE that could even escalate further in the future, as Saudi Arabia is trying to shift the focus from Dubai to Riyadh. To maintain its position, the UAE has introduced the Golden Visa in an attempt to attract actors and Arab stars, enticing them with high salaries and long-term residence visas with the aim of polishing its image in the world. But all those efforts go in vain when people see the massacres committed against Palestinian people in Gaza.
Now, a few years ago, you were sentenced to 30 months imprisonment for allegedly insulting the military in Lebanon. That was news. Tell us more about that, and how do such instances affect both affected you and both affect press freedom?
When an explosion rocked Beirut port on August 4th, I was working on a report on nitrates present in the port. After reviewing the result of the investigation, I discovered that the negligence of military officers was the main cause of the incident, as they had allowed such hazardous chemicals to remain there for 7 years. Even if an attacker caused the explosion, or it was later revealed that Israel was behind this explosion, the army still bears responsibility for the presence of that large amount of nitrate in the port, as stipulated by the law. When I publicly expressed this view, the commander of the Lebanese army decided to prevent me from entering the military court and all military institutions. So I criticized the commander of the Lebanese army in an interview, saying he acted like a militia leader and violated the law. According to the law, he should have filed a lawsuit against me, and I would have respected the court's decision. The military courts and institutions are not his personal property to prevent me from entering them. He is just an employee and receives salary from taxes paid by the Lebanese people. In response, the commander deployed forces to besiege my home in Beirut and my workplace to arrest me forcibly. That sparked anger in the media, forcing him to retreat. Subsequently, the head of the Higher Judicial Council intervened and prevented the army from arresting me. Nevertheless, they proceeded to sue me in the military court. Remarkably, the last time a journalist was tried by a military court was 50 years ago, and that journalist was Hassan Twenni, one of the founders of Al-Nahar newspaper. Seeing the same military court sentencing a journalist to prison after 50 years highlights the bad refuse to appear in the military court and asserted that I should be tried in the publications court for expressing my opinion. When I just expressed my opinion, they suppressed and intimidated me. Legislation absolutely poses a danger to journalists and prevents them from doing their job. Still, Lebanon stands at the forefront of Arab countries in terms of freedom of opinion and expression, and we as Lebanese journalists are still able to express our opinions. However, journalists should know how to lead the battle, even amidst authorities' attempts to silence us. If the journalist is assured that they are supporting the truth, then they should remain steadfast as they are carrying out their duty and saying the truth. By the way, journalism is my hobby, and I work as a journalist because of my passion. However, my source of income comes from television production and the production of documentaries and other work associated with the production company. Despite the challenges, I decided to work as a journalist because it satisfies me and helps me express my views. As Said Afreha aptly put it, journalism is the profession of looking for trouble.
That hasn't affected your following the truth?
No, at all.
Okay, let's move on to your main niche, your main strong point, which is making documentaries and films and all that. First of all together, how many films have you made?
I've made at least 42 documentaries, and some of which were broadcast on Al Jazeera. I was the director of documentaries aired on Al Jazeera and a producer of other documentaries made for other TV channels. Most of the films I produced were political and investigative, revealing special information and secret documents. Some of them focus on jihadist groups and corruption. This complex work requires time and follow-up. Currently, I'm working on a film named How to Become a Terrorist. It revolves around how people are brainwashed and persuaded to kill themselves and kill innocent people. I really do wish to make a number of documentaries on music, particularly the magnificent music in Iran. That'll be good to make a documentary on that kind of music and its relation with the cultures of people, whether in Iran or the entire region. As the music taste of people depends on their class, such as a documentary could help improve the artistic taste of the audience. Furthermore, I'm also working on a documentary on the Israeli enemy's recruitment of spies and how the Israeli regime infiltrated into the Lebanese society to recruit agents, such as suspenseful films attract viewers. Actually, there's no demand for other genres or TV channels.
And is there a certain style you follow in your documentaries that makes your line of documentaries unique? In terms of production, in terms of directing, in terms of, you know, how you frame your...
لك شو في سلسلة اشتغلت عليها.
I've made a series of films focusing on the political families in Lebanon, such as the Al-Jumbalat family and the Faragniya family. Recently, I made a film on Michel Aflaq, the founder of Al-Baath Party in Syria and Iraq. These documentaries serve as historical records. My style involves consistently exploring new topics and creating documentaries that reveal previously unseen content for the first time or figures appearing for the first time. That's why I was expanding my connections. Some accuse me of having ties with the security and intelligence apparatuses. But given that I'm working for Al-Akhbar professionally, for example, any journalist needs to record the interview or write down notes in order not to forget the information. But people like the officer, the judge, or the wanted individual feel scared when they see the journalist recording the interview. Therefore, I memorize their remarks in order not to scare them so they can provide me with the needed information. I also keep in contact with people and read between the lines to reach the truth.
We thank our guest Radwan Murtada from Lebanon for taking part in this program. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team here, it's goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. President Biden has apologized to Native Americans for abusive government-funded boarding schools and for forcibly removing Native American children from their families. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. President Biden on Friday, 25th of October, offered a long-overdue formal apology from the U.S. government for the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative, describing it as one of the most horrific chapters in American history. The U.S. Department of the Interior says the program, which lasted over a 150-year period, that ended in 1969, established 408 schools across 37 states to culturally assimilate American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiian children by forcibly removing them from their families and communities and teaching them new languages, religions, and cultural beliefs. After 150 years, the United States government eventually stopped the program, but the federal government has never formally apologized for what happened until today. President Biden told an audience while speaking at the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona, he said, "I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did to these children. I formally apologize. That's long overdue." At first in the 1800s, the effort was voluntary, asking tribes to send their children away to vocational schools. But then the federal government mandated the removal of children from their families and tribes, launching what's called the Federal Indian Boarding School Era. President Biden added, "This is one of the most horrific chapters in American history. We should be ashamed, a chapter that most Americans don't know about. Generations of Native American children stolen, taken away to places they didn't know, with people they never met, who spoke a language they had never heard. Native communities silenced, their children's laughter and play were gone." Biden told the audience, "Children would arrive at schools, their clothes taken off, their hair that they were told was sacred was chopped off, their names literally erased, replaced by a number or an English name. At least 973 Native American children died during the program, during which more than 18,000 were taken from their families and parents, according to the Associated Press." Cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. President Joe Biden on Friday, 25th of October, formally apologized for Native Americans for what he described as one of the most horrific chapters in American history. Government-funded boarding schools that abused indigenous children and forced them to assimilate over a 150-year period. President Biden said, "Quite frankly, there is no excuse that this apology took 150 years to make." Biden was speaking in Laveen, Arizona, after calling for a moment of silence to remember those lost and the generations living with that trauma. At least 18,000 children were taken from their families and forced to attend more than 400 boarding schools across 37 states, or then territories, between 1819 and 1969. 3 years ago, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Native American to serve as a cabinet secretary, commissioned the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative to review the school's impacts on Native Americans. Their final report, issued this summer, found at least 973 Native American children died whilst attending these federal boarding schools. As president, Biden said on Friday, "I believe it is important, but we do know that there were generations of Native children stolen, taken away to places they didn't know, with people they never met, who spoke a language they had never heard of. Native communities were silenced. Their children's laughter and play were gone." President Biden added, "Children abused emotionally, physically, and sexually, forced into hard labor, some put up for adoption without the consent of their birth parents, some were left for dead, and some were buried in unmarked graves. Children who returned home," the president added, "were wounded in body and spirit." President Biden's remarks were made at the Giller Crossing Community School outside of Phoenix, Arizona. It's the first time he has visited Indian country as president, and the first time in 10 years a sitting president has visited tribal lands. Then President Barack Obama paid a visit to the Standing Rock Sioux Indian Reservation back in 2014. Biden acknowledged that no apology can or will make up for what was lost during the darkness of the federal boarding school policy. But he added, "We're finally moving forward into the light." The president was briefly interrupted during his remarks by two pro-Palestinian protesters. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. On Friday, President Joe Biden formally apologized for the United States government's role in running at least 523 Indian boarding schools. His remarks were given at the Giller Crossing Community School outside of Phoenix, Arizona, and marked his first visit to Indian country as U.S. president. Biden said, after 150 years, the United States government eventually stopped the program. But the federal government has never formally apologized for what has happened until today. I formally apologize as President of the United States of America for what we did. I formally apologize, and that's long overdue. President Biden added, federal Indian boarding school policy, the pain it has caused will always be a significant mark of shame, a blot on American history. For too long, this has happened with virtually no public attention. Indian boarding schools were run with the express goal to kill the Indian in him and save the man, a phrase coined by the Army officer Richard Henry Pratt, who founded Carlisle Indian Boarding School, the first federally run Indian boarding school in the United States. From 1819 to 1969, in what Biden called one of the most horrific chapters in American history, the U.S. government directly managed or funded Indian boarding schools in nearly 40 states. The schools at which formal education was limited forcibly and systematically stripped indigenous children of their culture by removing them from their families and communities, forbidding them from speaking in their own native language, and typically violently punishing them if they resisted. A U.S. Department of the Interior report released earlier this year found that at least nearly 1,000 indigenous children died in these schools. Dr. Denise Lajimordier, an enrolled citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and one of the founders of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, wrote that the boarding school era represented a deliberate policy of ethnocide and cultural genocide and human rights abuses. Dr. Denise Lajimordier said, some of our elders who are boarding school survivors have been waiting all of their lives for this moment. Black and white.
La particularidad es la forma de enfrentar cualquier acontecimiento. Hablan de un contenido y de una manera.
The particularities, the way of dealing with any event, speak of its characteristics and the way to understand things. If we analyze the way the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out Operation True Promise 2,
verdadera número dos, que significó responder a la acción,
which meant responding to the criminal actions carried out by the Zionist entity that occupies Palestine, not only in Lebanon but even in Iran, it speaks for itself. The objectives were military bases, or the center of evil, or in other words, the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service.
O del centro de la maldad, por llamarle de alguna manera como la Mossad, de servicios secretos israelíes. Esos fueron los objetivos.
Those were the objectives, and above all, the punishment of the Zionist occupier. In comparison to Iran's military response, you will understand how different is the way Zionism carries out its actions on Gaza, on the civilian population, on children, women, on Lebanon. Ordinary people are bombed on a daily basis, and yet they claim that they sought the leaders of resistance.
Diciendo que hay que buscar a determinados dirigentes de la resistencia.
But the truth is that the objectives is extermination and genocide. These speak of two diametrically opposed conceptions.
Distinto es.
On one side of the story, in the midst of the bombardments of South Lebanon by the Zionist SWAR planes, planes carrying humanitarian aid arrived from Tehran to Beirut with food, with medicine.
Humanitaria, con alimento, con medicina, y cuando incluso rompiendo todo el cerco llega.
In addition, the foreign ministers of the Islamic Republic of Iran, breaking the entire siege, arrives to have a meeting in the middle of the war with the leaders of Lebanon.
Del Líbano. Eso habla de dos concepciones del mundo que se enfrentan. No solamente se
This speaks of two world conceptions that are in conflict. It is not only a question of whether the Zionist entity survives or not, but whether a fraternal, humanitarian way of thinking is still existent, in which the human being is at the center of everything. Well, maybe this way of thinking has been canceled out, and what some ministers of the Zionist entity have announced about Lebanon, and of course about Gaza, will take place, to make them go back to the Stone Age if they do not finish them off.
Si no los terminan.
There are two concepts that are in conflict. That is why comparing the axis of resistance led by the Islamic Republic of Iran
a la República Islámica de Irán
with the Zionist entity is absolutely impossible when looking for any similarity.
Imposible a la hora de buscar alguna similitud.
There is none because their objectives are different.
Porque sus objetivos son distintos. Por un lado,
on the one hand, the axis of resistance in what is the Islamic Republic of Iran, there is pure humanism and people are at the center of everything.
La gente en el centro de todo. Por otro lado, en la entidad sionista.
On the other hand, in the Zionist entity, there is hatred, genocide, apartheid, simply oppressing.
Simplemente castigar y hacer desaparecer.
And making a nation disappear because that is what their supremacist, racist conception of other peoples demands.
Sobre los demás pueblos. Eso es lo que está en juego.
That is what is at stake. That is what is happening. The hegemonic press hides that essence, that fundamental struggle.
Y por cierto, también oculta.
And by the way, they also hide how the Zionists were punished in the latest retaliatory attack of the Islamic Republic of Iran and how over 80% of the objectives were achieved. And we're talking about military objectives. We're talking about military and police targets.
Eso no lo nombra.
They don't give out the numbers. Even entire hangars of the Zionist Air Force were destroyed. Therefore, there are two conceptions, two ways of thinking.
Dos concepciones, dos maneras. Una.
One will surely prevail, and that is what we all bet on, the humanitarian one, the one led by the resistance. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hablar de la República Islámica de Irán y de la identidad sionista.
Talking about the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Zionist entity could be based on the characteristics that are expressed in concrete battles, in concrete confrontations.
No. En la enfrentamiento concreto.
But I think it is interesting to talk about its essence, its ideological and political content.
¿A quién sirven? ¿Por qué están de pie?
Who do they serve? What are they based on? What is the fundamental essence that the Islamic Republic of Iran has had since 1979?
La República Islámica de Irán. ¿Y qué ha pasado con?
And how has the terrorist Zionist group come to this stage, a group that has always been terrorist since before occupying Palestine, more than 76 years ago? An entity that was later referred to as honorable and democratic under the umbrella of American imperialism and a large part of the European Union.
Para hablar sobre estos temas, estamos hoy día con un invitado especial.
To talk about these issues, We're today with a special guest who lives in Brazil and is a Brazilian, Breno Altman, a journalist, founder of the news portal Opera Mundi, which addresses various social and political issues, especially in Latin America and Western Asia.
Especialmente de América Latina y de Asia Occidental. Bienvenido,
Breno, welcome to Black and White.
Negro y Blanco por Hispan TV.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's an honor to be with you.
Breno, ¿cómo?
Breno, how can we distinguish at the most ideological and essential level the differences between the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is at the head of the axis of resistance on the one hand, and the Zionist entity which occupies the Palestinian lands?
La entidad sionista que ocupa las tierras palestinas.
Yo creo que la cuestión fundamental tiene que ver...
I think the fundamental question has to do with the interests of the imperial system led by the United States. That is the fundamental question. Let us remember that with the 1979 revolution, Iran left the imperialist system with the Islamic Republic. Iran became one of the antagonists to the imperialist system in the Middle East. Israel, on the other hand, has been the bridgehead of the United States in that same region since 1948, fulfilling a role very similar to what it fulfilled during the period of the British Empire and the British colonial mandate over Palestine, when Israel did not even exist. The issue is that Israel is the tool for the United States to clean up the Middle East, and cleaning up the Middle East for imperialism means overthrowing the Islamic Republic of Iran. Without Iran, the United States would have a free hand to control the Middle East from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. That is a substantial control over a region that, in addition to its very important geographic characteristics in geopolitical terms, is a region that controls where there is 60% of the world's oil. So fundamentally, that is the issue. That is, the United States has Israel as its bridgehead, as that guard post in the Middle East. Iran is the country, the main country of resistance to this imperialist hegemony, very linked obviously to the Palestinian resistance, very linked to the organizations of the Muslim Arab world, which is still continue to fight imperialism hegemony and everything that imperialist hegemony means in the Middle East.
Así es. Pero Irán, además de eso, en sus fundamentos, ¿no? Ellos buscan indiscutiblemente la soberanía, la independencia, el desarrollo de toda Asia Occidental.
Yes, but Iran, in addition to that, in its foundations, unquestionably seeks sovereignty, independence, and the development of all of West Asia. And one thing that prevents this, as you have explained there, is this Western European North American base installed there. Well, the image that they strive to display to the world is that as if there is a struggle between two conceptions, a democratic Western and a ferocious dictatorship. What do you think of this caricature that is placed and that is in the hegemonic media every day?
¿Qué te parece a ti esa caricatura que se coloca y que está en los medios hegemónicos todos los días?
Se trata de una de las mentiras más...
This is one of the most brutal lies in history. If you look at the history of humanity, the most tyrannical dictatorships, the cruelest wars all come from the West. Western civilization is the one that gave us Hitler and fascism. It is the one that gave us colonialism and the death of tens of millions of people in Asia or Africa or Latin America. Western civilization, by all accounts, is a great humanitarian failure. In other words, besides the fact that it is obviously wrong to think that one can export one's civilizational model to another society, if one had to choose a model, it certainly could not be the Western model, which is a great failure.
Que es un gran fracaso.
Así es,
That's right, Breno. Well, let's take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds.
Dentro de unos segundos. Estamos de vuelta con Breno Altman, que es un periodista brasileño que tenemos el placer de tenerlo acá en el estudio.
We're back here in the studio with Breno Altman, a Brazilian journalist. Breno, today there is a concrete idea that the Zionist entity is a terrorist regime, an entity that we already said was born from terrorism, and then it cleaned up. And those who cleaned up its face were the same oppressors as always. But, well, they announced that they are fighting against Hamas, Hezbollah, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Popular Liberation Front, etc.
Mueren niños, mujeres, ancianos. Las bombas caen en hospitales, en escuelas.
But the truth is, they bomb the cities and massacre children, women, and old people. The bombs fall on hospitals, on schools. They are practically conducting terrorist actions, simply an ethnic cleansing, for the sake of the messianic dream to build an Israel that only exists in the head of the Zionist organization.
Look, I think that historically, the Zionist entity has always used genocide as an instrument of the strategic policy. In other words, what is genocide in the hands of the Zionist entity? The search to impose terror on the Palestinian people. So that terror makes the Palestinians leave their territories. That has always been present since the 1910s and 1920s of the last century. The use of terror against the Palestinian population so that they would give up their lands, so that they would surrender them to the Zionists, so that they would seek refuge in other countries in such a way that Zionist colonization could advance over the entire region that is called historic Palestine. We must also always remember that the strategic objective of Zionism goes beyond historic Palestine. The biblical reconstruction proposed by Zionism, sometimes more openly, other times more veiled, the biblical reconstruction proposed by Zionism is of the so-called Greater Israel, which is the territory where the United Kingdom of Israel and Judah would have existed 1,000 years before Christ. That territory, in current terms, corresponds to almost all of Iraq, all of Lebanon, all of Jordan, a large part of Syria, a large part of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, and also part of Egypt. That would be, let us say, the proposition, the ultimate strategic objective of Zionism. And genocide operates as a tool to expel the peoples of these regions, especially the Palestinian people, or to exterminate them if the Palestinian people do not accept their destiny of living outside their lands, their territories, or their destiny of living absolutely dependent on Zionist colonialism.
Absolutamente superdetado al colonialismo sionista.
Así es. Breno, esta segunda operación verdadera promesa de Irán que significó.
Yes, Breno. Operation True Promise 2, which was a real promise by Iran, was to unmask and reveal what Israel's hegemonic media had to prevent and hide, the fact that the Iron Dome is not enough to help Israel from being attacked. This, however, on the other hand, demonstrated a capacity on the part of Iran, and now also of Yemen, not only against the occupying Zionists, but also against France and particularly against the United States, who operate in the shadows.
Y particularmente contra Estados Unidos, quienes manejan en la sombra.
How do you see the development of this? Because surely a new event is on the horizon.
En, ¿cómo se llama? En puerta, seguramente nuevo acontecimiento.
Mira, la idea de la invencibilidad es fundamental para el Estado de Israel.
Look, the idea of invincibility is fundamental for the entity of Israel. That is to say, the idea of invincibility is especially important for Israel to develop its strategy of terror against the Palestinian people and against any country that wishes in a particular way to present itself in solidarity with the Palestinian people. But here, Iran has managed to break through the Iron Dome and the other anti-aircraft instruments of Israel. Iran has demonstrated a fairly significant military capacity in terms of air, which is the great strength of the Zionist regime and its allies. When Iran manages to have that level of military capacity and demonstrates it very clearly in its retaliatory attack against Israel, this generates a different spirit in the region. People realize that Israel is not invincible, that they can defeat the Zionist regime. In addition, it surely lifts the spirit of the troops in the Middle East, who are ready to confront the Zionist entity. It is true that Israel must be evaluated with great caution, especially from a geographical point of view. they are far from each other, so it is not a war that can immediately be an infantry or artillery war. It is fundamentally an air war, but in this area, Iran is showing that Israel's invincibility is a lie, and exposing this huge lie is very significant for the fight against the Zionist regime.
Importante para el enfrentamiento contra el régimen sionista.
Ahora, esto se da en un contexto internacional también bastante complejo. Tenemos la operación especial de Rusia en Ucrania.
Now, this is taking place in an international context that is also quite complex. We have the Russian special operation in Ukraine, which is having a very significant success. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is complex, and also with regard to the Taiwan Strait. The situation is very complex internationally. Well, the United States and the West apparently do not have the capacity to move, despite all their power. And this power is seen to be in decline from an economic point of view. The crises are affecting them because Iran, in its military development, was not affected as much by the blockade and the sanctions, but rather it has managed to accumulate enough military equipment, which is also of primary importance. Can we say that the existence of the Zionist entity is linked to the maintenance or support of this collective West?
También a la mantención o no de este occidente colectivo?
Seguramente, porque delante de la decadencia del sistema imperialista.
Certainly, because in the face of the decline of the imperialist system, the command of that system, which is in the hands of the United States, has decided on a path to confront that decline. That path is the path of war. That is very clear today. Whether in Ukraine, in the Middle East, in the China Sea, or in all parts of the world in which the United States operates, the card that the United States plays is the card of war. And that is what generates this insecurity, this tension, this brutal scenario that we live in today. The United States very clearly considers that it is in the military field that it maintains its superiority over Russia, over China, and over the allies of China and Russia. The United States believes that the large countries of the West maintain this military advantage, and that this military advantage can be overcome very quickly, and that, therefore, this military advantage must be immediately used, generating a situation of maximum wear and tear for this large anti-imperialist camp that is being organized around China and Russia, in which Iran is evidently present. It is not an anti-imperialist system, as the socialist system has been. It is a camp with different political and economic regimes. But the United States very clearly decided to confront this camp on the military terrain. That is why the world is currently in a very dangerous stage.
Peligroso y de mucha lucha en ese momento.
Así es. Ahora, desde un punto de vista...
That's right. Now, from a cultural and ideological point of view, we are considering the developments of the day. Iran, for example, has shown a lot of patience and care in maintaining peace, etc. It is not that it is seeking war, but that it is forced to face war. How do you see it? Because the hegemonic press is actively showing a negative image of Iran in this face-off. In addition, Iran took its time and was patient to respond to Israel's atrocities. Iranian President Dr. Pezeshkian has explained it very well.
Lo ha explicado muy bien.
Claro. ¿A quién interesa la regionalización de la guerra en Medio Oriente? Es a Israel.
Of course, who is interested in the regionalization of war in the Middle East? It is Israel. The more war there is in the region, the more confident Israel is that it'll keep the United States and the European Union as its allies. Iran is not interested in war because it is very clear that the United States and the European Union will be on Israel's side in the event of a war. Iran knows that the same does not apply to Russia and China.
We shouldn't forget that before this new Iranian Operation True Promise 2 against the Zionist entity, the secretary of the Russian Federation was in Tehran the day before.
Russo, de la Federación Rusa, un día antes estaba en Teherán.
¿Lavrov?
Lavrov.
Yes, Lavrov.
Claro, que son las consultas porque...
It's a very interesting element. Of course, there are consultations because what is the dynamic on which Israel is betting? Provocation against Iran, forcing Iran to react militarily. a military reaction that can serve as a pretext for an escalation. With the escalation, Iran is forced to war. By forcing Iran to war, the United States and the European Union support Israel. But in those conditions, Israel would have a more favorable correlation of forces, because it is doubtful that Russia and China will give Iran the same support that the United States will surely give Israel. So that is Israel's bet. And Iran knows that it does not have, let's